Hello, my name is Eve Waltermore, and I'll be talking about leveraging electronic health records and specific demographic data to screen for hepatitis B in a community health center. I have no relationships to disclose. So the organization that I'm representing is called the Institute for Family Health. There are 17 full-time federally qualified health centers in New York City, covering two of the five boroughs and New York City, Manhattan and the Bronx, and also in three upstate counties. We have also school-based health programs, four dental centers, mental health centers, free clinics, homeless shelters, and actually, when I did this slide, we had two family medicine residency programs. We now have three. A little bit over 300,000 patient visits, 90,000 unique patients, and you could see that most of these are indigenous populations that we're serving. I'm going to talk a little bit about hepatitis B, although the story today is a little bit about hepatitis B and a little bit about how to identify certain at-risk people that relate to their immigrant status. So approximately 800,000 people, or 1.4 million, infected in the United States. It's vaccine preventable. In 2008, there was about 38,000 new infections. The big things, which will relate to what I'm going to talk about today, is that 90% of those who are infected perinatally develop chronic hepatitis B. And what that means is they're more likely to have the complications, have the chronic sequelae that comes with having hepatitis B. It's not, so those are the people who get it perinatally. When you get it as an adult, it's actually much easier to treat and they're much less likely to have those kinds of outcomes. So we're really specifically concerned about those people who are getting it perinatally. 1.4 of them will die of these complications. And that most who are affected perinatally from Hep B come from Hep B endemic countries. So in response to this, the Department of Health and Human Services has this action plan that for an increase of the proportions of people who are aware of their Hep B status, they're also their Hep C status, reduction in the number of new cases, and the elimination of mother-to-child transmissions. So here's a little bit of the challenge. So we have the U.S. Preventive Service Task Force basically giving a D recommendation recommending against routine screening for the general population, and this really relates to the fact that in the United States, most people who are living here who are not of immigrant status get the adult onset Hep B, and it's really much more treatable. It's also a smaller proportion, and so they're recommending against the screening. However, we also have the CDC recommendations that the Hep B surface antigen, which is what that symbol means, is now recommended for additional populations. So in addition to men who have sex with men, injection drug users, and while it doesn't say this, it's also people who engage in high-risk sexual behaviors who aren't necessarily men who have sex with men, but also those people who come from a geographic region that has a prevalence of 2% or higher. And then again, these are the people that we're particularly interested in. Not that we're not interested in the other group. They're the ones who we've been screening for a long time now. It's this recognition that there's this other risk group. And again, they're the ones who are really at risk for having the chronic Hep B and the more life-threatening one. So this is a slide that shows you which countries have a prevalence of 2% or more. And so if you look at the lightest blue, that's the group that's not from an endemic country, and the rest of them are. So that's a really large population. And coming from New York City specifically, we have a lot of people from all those other Hep B endemic countries that we're seeing in our sites. So we have another problem, and for any of you who work in the clinical care, we have a real problem with the lack of standardization in how we categorize just race and ethnicity. So let's forget about country of origin for a second. First, we had this thing where we classified race and ethnicity together, so we had non-Hispanic white, non-Hispanic black, Hispanic age, and then they realized, well, we got to divide this up. Let's ask ethnicity in one category. Let's ask race in another category. And it gets even more challenging because, again, any of you who work in a clinical setting, is it the person who's doing the intake who looks at the person and guesses what they are, or is the person filling it out themselves? And, you know, and it's not standardized. And so in each of these different clinical practices, it's slightly different how they're just determining race and ethnicity. And the reason why that's important to be bringing up is because we're trying to go farther than race and ethnicity. Race and ethnicity is actually not enough to determine if they're from a HEPB endemic country. You actually have to know what country they're from. So we've got to start with that problem and move a little bit further. Okay, so this is what we do at the Institute, and this is just for race and ethnicity first. So we because it's, again, standardizing what you ask and how you ask it. Those are two very important things. So we start with asking Hispanic ethnicity, yes or no, then it's race. By the way, our patients fill this out themselves. It used to be that they were at first, the intake person would look and guess, then they were asked, people were very uncomfortable, and now we have our patients fill this out themselves. There is no magic way of doing this. So we ask race, and then we move on to something called granular ethnicity. I'll show you a little bit more about what that is, but what happens with granular ethnicity is, you know, we find that we have patients who might be from Cuba or from Ukraine who none of the races or ethnicities apply to them. And so they're just saying none or other or skipping it. And I'll show you how that granular ethnicity works. We also ask for language proficiency. So what you see, this is what our electronic records look like. And we've been using, we're one of the first community health centers to be using electronic health records. We started in 2002 with a program called EPIC, which as a result, we got a CDC Center for Excellence grants in 2007 to demonstrate sort of that public health clinical collaboration. And so you see there, we have a place that we ask country of birth and so that they can let us know what country of birth they're from. And this is, you see there's a drop down so that we can identify all of the different potential countries that they may come from. So I lied, I don't have the granular ethnicity because this is not about granular ethnicity, this particular talk, although we are looking at that stuff too. So what happens is if in the intake it gets entered that they're from a country, from an endemic country, what happens is a BPA, a best practice alerts, a smart set pops up in the screen in front of the provider, and it says, patient is from a hepatitis B endemic country, we recommend testing, and it allows them to click on it in order to do this testing. As you see, we're testing for the surface antigen. It's much more, as a screening tool, you want to be testing for surface antigen. It's a lot more complicated on testing for Hep B. The surface antigen doesn't necessarily mean they have Hep B. They need to be tested twice within a six-month period. But this is the screening tool. Okay, so now that's just sort of a little background. This is what, since we've implemented this country of origin, what have we found, what kind of changes are happening? And so the first, we looked after 5 months and just said what's happening as a result of having this now. When I say fires, that means that it popped open on a screen. And so little over 32,000 fires occurred in a five-month period. So that shows you how many people are showing up from these countries. Now, they're not unique patients. A patient could come more than once in 5 months, and so that they may count as those fires. Not a lot of people come multiple times in 5 months, but it is possible. Of those, about 4,000 were acknowledged, which means that the provider sort of opened up the smart set, and then of that, 785 tests were ordered. And then we just did a chart review of all of the tests that were done just to confirm and found that just in that 10-month period, 10 previously unknown cases of Hep B were identified. So then we went 7 months and said, okay, now how are we doing? And what you find is we're definitely doing a lot more Hep B testing. We went from about 1,600 Hep B screens to 3,300. But you also could see from the light blue that a large proportion of those, this is really a big part of this increase is identifying and screening people who are from Hep B endemic countries. So the blue dot is larger because it's a proportional thing. So when we screened less and we only found 12 people at Hep B, it was a proportionately larger than screening and getting 1,610 screens and getting only 28. But the fact is even this is not about sensitivity or specificity. It's really just a net that we cast, and we found that we got 28 cases as compared to 12. So we confirmed this with chart diagnosis, and you see that from the patients from endemic countries, we're having a lot more, identifying a whole bunch more that have Hep B that were not identified before. Then we looked after 1 year, and what I find most interesting about this, so the green bar will tell you the total. So for the Asian Pacific Islanders, the prevalence of the Hep B positives for the surface antigen was 2.5, but clearly from those who are from an endemic country, it was considerably higher than those who are non-endemic countries. The most was for the black African Americans, where those from an endemic country, the prevalence was over 5% compared to only 1.3% of the ones who were U.S. born. And so you can see in every single race, those people from endemic countries were having a higher rate of Hep B than those who aren't. And so to correct this is not the one-year relative risk of Hep B, but of a positive surface antigen for a Hep B. And so what we find is that there's nearly a 2 times increased likelihood of Hep B if the person is from an endemic country. We have news. Our latest BPA includes a few other things. So we now have that if they're from an endemic country, not only to do the surface antigen, but also other screenings for other kinds of viral diseases. So we're expanding upon this process of using country of origin to identify risk. Our future directions, we need to do more training for residents. Again, Hep B is a very complicated thing to treat, more provider education, and we're moving to making the smart set, that's this computer system, a smart set to help us manage the patients. So this just tells us how to find them. Now we need to know what to do with them and have guide providers and how to respond to this. If you do treat populations that are potentially at risk for Hep B, these are some tools, and I know you can download these from the website. The first one is great. If you are a clinician in any way, it actually walks you through if you did this and you found this and you should do this, and it's really a lovely, quick, easy screen tool that tells you exactly what to do if you have a patient that you're concerned about for Hep B. So I strongly recommend. The other ones are good, too, but that first one is really excellent. And it will. All my notes are on there, so you can. I see you're taking a picture of it, but you can get it. I swear, you'll get it from the APHA website. It's all there. But it's soapnote.org, if that's easier to just write down. And there's the contact information if there's any questions. And that's it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, all panel. We do it right on time. You're going way out of time. So I'm very happy you guys finished right on time. So question for the panel, please.
I have a question for Megan about Cambodian population. I'm a South Cambodian. And I have a question that using technology to do the need assessment, how challenging it is? Because my last question is like, are those community health workers who conduct a survey Cambodian, yeah, are they trained? And then what is challenging? Because I have worked with the community health workers. They also somehow could not navigate the technology by themselves, and then that is a big challenge when they ask them to work, even though we provide some training, but still some challenges. So how are you going to cope with those challenges?
Thank you very much for your question and your work. All of the community health workers in this project were Cambodian and had been working generally for at least several years with the Cambodian nonprofit that they worked at. A little more than half have had previous experience using handheld technology and iPads prior to the start of the study, but there was about maybe a third who had not. And so we did really spend a lot of time on the training. And one of the things that we found was critical was to have access to tech people available as they were out doing the study. So we had the several tech people at our home base in Connecticut being available through cell phone to walk them through that even when they were out in the field. But generally, we have them practice a fair amount before going out in the field to help work out some of those bugs. But as you saw from the slides, they still had problems with the technology freezing when they were out there, and also with some connectivity issues. The community health workers were really dedicated. I also give a lot of kudos to the community participants who obviously felt the study was important to them. because they often got them to agree to move to a little bit different location, you know, so that they could have better connectivity and complete the study. So we really had hardly anyone starting the survey, which was a relatively brief survey because we were most interested in testing the feasibility and effectiveness of using this technology. We had very few people drop out once, you know, they encountered one of these technological problems. Now, I didn't report this, but about 60% of the participants of the 371 got some assistance from the community health worker at the beginning of the survey in being able to navigate, because we have the participants, this is my iPad, we had the Alex prompt. Now we had the participants, an option for them, and we wanted to encourage them to actually press all the buttons, and that's how we did our informed consent, because we were able to get, so we didn't need to have them sign a consent form. We had expedited our review, so this was by touching that, they were actively showing their consent. So there still are challenges to be worked out, but you know, it was very possible. But I think because of the real dedication of the community health workers, as well as the community seeing that these were issues that were relevant and important to them, because they developed the whole questions, you know, so we weren't. It was an organic process.
I'm sorry, Megan, just to add up on that, are you also, in the study, has also included the subpopulation that is hard to reach, like religious leaders, like monks, and also the subpopulation of Cambodia called Muslim Cambodian, which is really hard to reach, and they really engage or participate in the study because of religious beliefs. They don't want to be with other regular population at all. Have you engaged those on their voice in the study too?
Yeah, this is a pilot study, and so we were able to engage monks and people at temples because that was some of the places that they went to. But I don't believe we're still analyzing the results. But I don't believe we effectively engaged the Muslim Cambodians. And thank you for that. That's an important population we need to reach out to more.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, my name is Florence, and I'm a nurse in the Shades in Health and also clinical faculty in Brazil. So, when I was studying, my question is for Ms. Hogan. For the immigrant population, the refugees that you determined that had problems with access in the healthcare system, did you or your project check to see if there was any access, they had an access. I know some of outpatient healthcare centers they have more advanced practice nurses or physician assistants, and then maybe an overhead physician. And I know some of the community members see that as a cheaper way of accessing the healthcare system. So did your project determine in the check to see if that was a cheaper option to seek healthcare versus going to a doctor or
whatever? Thank you for your question. We weren't looking at really generally the cost of care. We were just generally blanketly looking at, are you even accessing care at a basic level? And so what our challenge became was the fact that people did not have health insurance, they didn't have any health coverage, nor were they aware of some of the different venues in which they could go and seek out care. We have a federally qualified health center that they could access for free, even if they don't have health care services. We actually have two, but they didn't know about it. And then location is also a challenge there. And then the one resource that they are aware of, which is the county hospital, because that's where they are generally processed through our health department and then through the county. The relationship between our refugee population and our county hospital is a little bit strained. So there's some fear and there's some apprehension with even trying to go and seek out services. So for us, it was just a matter of trying to build capacity around knowledge about where those services were. Now, maybe in the future we could look at, okay, what would be more cost effective for you and your family, and what would be a better option? And the idea of using or identifying like nurse practitioners or PAs as another vehicle is something that we didn't necessarily explore, but I think it's something that I can definitely take back to my PI as an option for our refugee community.
Thank you. Hi, Anna.
Yeah, I forgot
the question. That's okay.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks to all of you guys for coming. My question is for those of you who presented about community health workers. What do you think, any of you want to speak to this, are the outcomes where you have the greatest possibility to achieve an impact with community health workers or patient advocates? Where do you think you can really demonstrate that you're seeing a change? I mean, we saw so many presentations that I'm having trouble keeping them all straight, but where do you see possibilities?
Well, for me, and just being, you know, the project coordinator on this particular project, I see two areas where there's a need. One, if we're going to use community health workers, they need to be, it needs to be a systemic change where they're actually included into like health services. So if they, like patient navigators, they need to be actually included, valued, and paid for their services. So, because that's the challenge. We're asking people to volunteer their services and go out into the community and do all of this work, but they also have to, they need employment. They need to pay for gas. They need to pay for cell phone minutes and things like that. And that was one of the challenges with us. And we paid our community health workers for their work. But again, after it's over, naturally some of them are going to continue to help their communities because that's where their heart is. But, you know, we're putting a burden on them. So we need to demonstrate their value by actually compensating them for their services. And in addition to that, for us, you know, sometimes we, getting them to health, to general health services is a challenge, but maybe meeting them where they are. And so our education programs are actually more enlightening, I think, than just saying you need to go to the doctor. For instance, we were doing a diabetes education, and we noticed that they were really engaged in, okay, so I don't necessarily have to continue to take medication to manage diabetes. There are other things that I can do to manage my diabetes. And so, and what we also found is we don't have a lot of culturally competent literature regarding diabetes management for these different refugee groups. So what are the foods that they eat traditionally, and what are the nutritional components of those foods, and how do I manage the foods that I eat, because these are the things that I already eat. How do I manage that and then control diabetes? It culminates with exercise and all those other things. So I think if we're going to engage them in health behaviors, and we're talking about things like diabetes and, you know, getting screenings maybe for Hep B, engaging that in a more of a community setting where it's more familiar, as opposed to like a rural group, a bunch of white walls where they may feel intimidated.
So. And I think I just want to add to that too, it's really important because they are not just a person there who lives in you, but they are the resource pool person. Mm-hmm. So every single problem that the community people have, they always go to their marriage, they have some kind of problem, funeral ceremony, everything. So they're not just having only physical or physical pain, but mental health is also a big component, especially from Asian immigrant community that they have suffered through trauma and stuff like that. They have a lot of mental health, and coming to the U.S., there are many issues around them to add the stress level comes to this side. By opening up, I mean by having a trusted community health worker, building up, they are trusted them, and then that's the key that opens everything. So they're so important. And the only thing that because I think the county is about, let's say that haven't recognized the importance of community health workers yet. So that should be a place where they can place their value within their system to compensate, or that they really can compensate their value in the community for why a certified course for all of them. Because not all other states they have a certified health navigator or patient navigator. So that is the key important.
And actually, I have a question.
I just want to say quickly, I mean, even though that's not this study, but I have another study, and it's a similar finding where their clinical outcomes don't improve more from those people who had the community health workers, but what you'll see from him, and it's the same thing we found, the clinical outcomes than from those who don't, because the ones who don't are getting something else. It's just different. And so it's really, they're all getting better. It just, you're not going to statistically see that the ones that got the letter home are doing better, because it's too holistic.
And I would also argue that when we evaluate, we shouldn't just evaluate, oh, is their glucose going down? Look at everything in their life. And even I would, Sister Katrina, the reimbursement should also just come from the healthcare system, because it's really affecting housing and employment.
Yeah.
And so they should really be looked at as resource, not just disease or even health specific, right. But in lives, but compensated.
Yeah.
I coordinate
with
my health worker firm, but yeah, really small results like the participants in the program.
My question has to do with the navigational model. I wonder, did you work with the community health workers at all or not?
We did, and our patient navigators.
Okay,
where
community health
community
workers?
Health workers.
Okay.
Actually, just I wanted to go back to a question. There's the county, Mineral County, City of Rochester has several projects going on regarding community health workers. It's a hot topic, and our patient navigators are a part of some of those projects. What we're seeing preliminarily with the data coming out of this project is that the community health worker is embedded in the practice, even if all their work is in the community, but if there's an embedding in the practice and being part of the healthcare team, the outcomes, however you're going to measure outcomes, seem to be better. And there's, you know, some publishable data that's supposed to come out soon around these practices in Rochester.
So in essence, if they themselves are part of the team working on the community health issues, then they have more effect on, the outcome is better for the community as a whole, because they were part of this team itself. Yes?
Did you find that when they're embedded in the health system that they lost a love, that there is a level of comfort lost in that? You know, no longer is it your neighbor helping you, but it's more professional type, possibly, because they're embedded in the system?
Yeah, you're asking around person, so I'm the outside looking in. I haven't seen it, because they're hired from the community, the representative of the community, and all of their work is in the community. But statistically, the University of Rochester studying this has found that the ones that are, there's that separation, that are fully community health workers versus community health workers in the practice, there seems to be a difference. And I don't know what that connection is. I think it's a lot about, you raise the cultural competency of the center itself by having this team a part of it.
Do you think that they might be a little more, there's more coordinated care within the other members of the team?
Perhaps.
Compared to if they're solely out there?
Perhaps. Again, I've been an outsider looking in.
Right.
I'm very interested to see the study.
Yeah,
that'd be
great.
Well, questions off the you about hepatitis B screening. Those are, your study was conducted in the clinical setting. So how about the screening that was conducted at community health screening event, where, let's say, this organization, they come, I'm going to provide 200 people with hepatitis B screening, and there's no follow-up after that. People got positive, they just send a letter, you are positive, this is the resource you're going to go. But I have a few cases of my clients that they have no way to navigate it, and the resources available for hepatitis are not really available, and the treatment of itself is so expensive. And even they are not costly, they are recommended to have a vaccine if they don't have antibiotic system in there, but they have no way to get that because it's like $400 for the whole 3 shots. So what is your approach to engage for those who got in the community event?
Well, the reason you screen, there's two reasons to screen, right? One is because if they do have Hep B and it's perinatally contracted, then they're really at risk of these chronic sequelae. And you want to say to them, listen, you know, something, it's not safe, you need to go further and find out more about this. This is just a surface antigen screen, it's only one thing, it doesn't mean you have Hep B, but it definitely means that you should go talk to some provider about this. The second is because of transmission, that if you don't know you have it, you're going to more likely give it to other people, whether it's your newborn child or the person that you're sexually active with. And so I think if those two messages just come out, that says, you don't know if you have this, but if you do, you could have a lot of health problems down the line, and you could be giving this to other people. And so this is just a screen. This just says there might be something wrong, and go find a provider.